I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 9th, 2014. This week, while you're hearing this, you should be thinking a little bit more about this. Also, we'll give advice about the people who are advising you, and of course, we'll be taking your money questions. But first, you may have heard this week that the head of Target, Greg Steinhoffel, was shown the exit, well, among other reasons, was last year's massive data breach that had Target customers, and maybe you, scrambling to protect themselves. So, where do we stand now with that breach, and what should you be doing to protect yourself? Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he's here to loop us in. Hiya, Ben.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. So, big week for Target, big week for former CEO Greg Steinhoffel. Are we surprised that this guy was handed his hat?
I don't think we're too surprised. He presided over Target suffering one of the biggest consumer data breaches in history. And, you know, I mean, when that kind of thing happens to your company, no matter whose fault it is, heads are probably going to roll.
Now, often when there's a breach of this magnitude, things kind of get hushed up afterwards. The dust settles and we never hear from it again. Target, however, has kind of raised the profile and stepped up and said, look, we're doing something. What are they doing?
Well, they seem to be pretty committed to turning things around. I mean, I think it would be hard for them to not make some efforts in this regard, considering just the size of this thing. The company has announced it's going to switch all of its payment kiosks at all stores in the U.S., and they'll be replaced by this coming September. That's a pretty big undertaking. There's about 1,800 stores around the country. Also, what's interesting here is that they're going to replace everybody's Target card. And what's really interesting about this is that the U.S. is way behind most of the rest of the world when it comes to credit card technology. I don't know if you've ever seen a credit card from Europe or Canada. It's usually got this fancy chip in it. That makes it harder for hackers to steal. But also, credit cards in other places in the world, you have a secret PIN attached to this credit card that you would enter just like your ATM card whenever you use it. So Target says it's going to replace all of its cards with these sort of chip and PIN cards.
Now, that's really interesting because the big credit card networks, Visa, MasterCard, have said, look, we've got to switch over to chip and PIN to make things more secure. They've given an October 2015 deadline, and yet Target seems to be stepping things up.
Well, Target is stepping things up. Now, the thing that sort of makes this complicated, right, is that retailers, other stores are not super psyched to make this transition because there's a couple things. First of all, it's really expensive. I mean, it's been estimated that this kind of transition could cost in the billions of dollars for retailers and stores around the country just to update their sort of payment methods, update cards, things like that. But also, there's another issue, which is efficiency. Now, when was the last time you went to lunch and, you know, paid under $25 and had to actually sign for the credit card that got swiped?
Well, it doesn't happen often, but on the other hand, I sure wouldn't mind a little more peace of mind when it came to my plastic.
Right. You wouldn't, right? So, you know, I think that a lot of stores are really eager to get as many customers through the door and past the cash register as possible, and they don't like this kind of extra tech, extra security. But as a consumer, you want that, right? We all want that. So I think that slowly but surely we're going to see this change. Target is doing this. Admittedly, Target's cards only work at Target, so it's not going to be something that's necessarily going to have a lot of dominoes fall. But I think once consumers might get used to more security, they might actually start calling for it from other places.
So in the meantime, as we wait for card issuers, as we wait for the retailers to stop dragging their feet, what should consumers be thinking about in terms of protecting their info, protecting their privacy?
Sure. Well, it's tough, right? But there are some best practices. Obviously, you want to consistently monitor your credit card activity and your bank activity as well. The way I usually do it is I do kind of a financial check-in on Sundays with my wife, and we look for purchases or charges that don't make sense. We kind of check all of our accounts, things like that. If you see something that's mysterious looking, you want to ask your credit card company or retailer who issued you a card if there's something weird going on. Check in with them. Also, you can change your passwords regularly to your other accounts, and that just sort of helps generally when it comes to data breaches and things like that. Also, you know, when your card wears out, get a new one. You'll have a new number. It'll be a little bit more secure that way.
So even checking your statement regularly might not be enough. I've seen reports that said the most common password out there is the word password. I'm guessing that's not a smart play.
It's not a smart play. One thing that's, you know, that I've been told by cybersecurity experts is, and this is really interesting, for whatever reason, if you have a password that is 12 characters or longer, that makes it much harder for hackers to hack your password. For whatever reason, the tools that they use have trouble with passwords that are 12 characters or longer. So that's something I always stick by.
And you can remember that?
I do my best.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We're always saying on this show that you should consult a financial advisor before making any big money decisions. So how do you find one? Or how do you know if you even need one? Here to help us sort out whether to bring in a pro or do it yourself is Lindsay Gelman, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Hiya, Lindsay.
Hi there.
All right. So finding a financial pro is a lot trickier than people might think. And the first question is, do you need one? When do you bring one in?
Exactly. It's a challenge to figure out when and sort of at what junctures you might need a financial pro. There are some arguments for and against actually hiring someone to manage your finances.
Now, let's say you've just got a meat and potatoes kind of portfolio. It's your 401k, maybe an IRA, maybe a college plan, and maybe some index funds on the side. Is that the kind of person who needs a little handholding?
It really depends, but traditionally speaking, no. And I spoke to a lot of financial advisors for this story that I wrote, and many of them said, hey, you know, you probably don't need our services if you have a pretty standard, simple financial arrangement. You know, it's not rocket science. You make sure that you're budgeting, you make sure you're saving enough for retirement, that you're buying enough insurance. And then beyond that, there are not that many tricks that are necessary.
So at what point do you cross over the Rubicon and become someone who is looking for a financial pro?
So the conventional wisdom is that when you start getting ready to retire, that's the point at which things get complicated even for a financially savvy investor. So there are a lot of things in the mix when you're getting ready for retirement. If there's a spouse in the picture, you have to decide at what point to start taking benefits like Social Security. You might have something like a pension. There are just a lot of different decisions to be made, and you might not have all the tools at your disposal to make those on your own.
Well, couldn't I just go online and do a search for things I should know at certain ages of my life?
You absolutely could, but that advice wouldn't be tailored to you specifically. So you would have to sort of take it with a large grain of salt.
So when you're looking for a financial advisor, there are various folk out there. Some of them charge a fee, flat fee. Some of them charge a commission. How do you do your search?
The kind of common sense here is to stick with a fee-only advisor because that person is not trying to sell you a financial product. And there are many different networks and organizations of advisors who adhere to these very strict fiduciary standards and who don't charge commission. And some of these advisors actually make sure that they open their practices to people who aren't necessarily wealthy. There are some that bill hourly. Others don't require minimum amounts of assets. Planners sort of run the gamut between someone who could help someone who's just starting out or has a relatively low income versus someone who's quite wealthy and has a very complex financial situation.
Well, let's say I'm in total financial Bob Vilas mode and I want to do it myself. What websites would you recommend?
So there are different sort of levels of ways to do it yourself. So there are some apps where you can simply track your spending, something like a mint.com or even learnvest.com. Those sites allow you to track your spending and then they organize it for you in these colorful graphics, charts, etc. You can see, oh, wow, I really spent a lot on entertainment this month or dining out. And you can set up alerts that kind of ping you when you're approaching an amount that you had set for yourself. So, you know, getting close to your entertainment budget this month, or, you know, don't eat out one more time, things like that. Then there are sites and software programs that are hybrids between a human advisor and an online sort of service. So not only do they help you track your spending, they actually invest money on your behalf. And that's sort of a different class of programs. And that would be something like Future Advisor. And you actually put some of your assets under their management. They charge a fee. And they invest according to principles laid out by their human advisors. And the program interacts almost constantly with your funds. So it makes trades and moves money on your behalf.
All right. So let's say you're going to take up the challenge. What are some of the common mistakes that people make when they try and get their hands around their finances?
So there are situations where the right thing to do financially might be counterintuitive, such as when you're rebalancing your portfolio. You might not want to hang on to losers and get rid of winners. So there are things that are sort of against the way that we would normally act if we were acting in the interest of our emotions. And for those types of transactions or those types of decisions, it might be useful to have somebody who forces you to act in the best interest of your finances rather than according to how you might be feeling at any particular time.
Sort of financial mommy or daddy.
Yeah.
Lindsay Gelman is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, I'll be taking your calls and answering some interesting financial questions. Later on, in this economy, college grads are told to pay off their student loans and pronto. But can paying off that debt cost them in the long run?
Debt is bad. Debt is bad. Pay off your student loans as soon as possible. And what you see is a bunch of kids doing that and passing up all these wonderful opportunities to save for retirement.
Liz Weston joins us to talk about matriculation and money. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Finally, we're up to my favorite part of the show, which is where it's your part of the show. We're going to deal with your questions and maybe get to the root of some money troubles. Our first call is from Orange County. It's Valerie, who I understand is getting married soon, which means a big Marketplace Mazel Tov to you, Valerie.
Thank you very much.
When's the big date?
September.
Ooh, that's coming on like a freight train, isn't it?
It is.
Are you ready?
I think so.
What? Tell me what's on your wish list in terms of what's on the registry.
Well, we would love if people would contribute to our honeymoon so we could travel.
Where are you going?
We're going to Thailand.
Ooh, I used to live in Thailand, actually.
No, that's
it's
great.
Nice. It's hot.
Fantastic. Well, we're really excited about it.
I'll bet you are. Okay, so tell me about your money situation.
Sure. So, like I said, I'm getting married in September, and I'm currently completely debt-free, luckily. I paid off all of my student loans a few years ago, but my fiancé has some significant student debt.
Define significant.
About $57,000.
Okay.
Okay. Significant to me. So, currently, he's making the minimum payment on that loan, while I'm currently saving. I have money that I earmark for saving every month. So my question is, what's going to benefit us the most financially in the long run, for him to continue making the minimum payments and for me to continue saving, or for me to shift some of my savings and begin helping him to pay down his debt?
Do you plan to do that before you wed or after you wed?
I plan on doing it after we get married, because we are planning on combining our finances, but not until after all the wedding and everything.
I just got to ask this, too. This is this marriage of the debt-free woman and the guy with the debt overhang. Does that say anything about your relationship?
No, I think that we're looking at things more of like a partnership. And David, my fiance, he got a later start on college than I did. So he went back to school and had a career shift. So I don't really consider us more of a saver and a spender as our personality goes, I think it's just the current situation is that he finished school a little bit later, so he still has his debt, and I don't.
So you're telling me that once that debt's gone, David, he straightens up and flies right?
Yeah, absolutely, because our only debt right now is that student debt.
Okay. All right, here's what I'm thinking, and that is the debt there right now, it's his problem, not yours.
Right.
Don't make it yours until it, you know, you've got a reason to make it yours. I like the idea of couples combining their finances. By couples, I mean married couples. I think that's just one of the epoxies that keeps a relationship together. And that's not to say it's easy, because
right.
money is a tough deal in a relationship. But it at least opens the door for having to work together, to getting on the same page and making some of the most important decisions of your life together. So I think that's good.
Great.
All right. But that said, I think you want to tread carefully here. I think when you do get together, I would ask David to step up the payments a little bit. If he's making the minimum payments right now, not good enough. All that's doing is prolonging the pain.
Right.
And whatever debt you have, especially credit card debt, when you make minimum payments, all you're doing is giving lots more money to other people and not using it for yourself. Never a good financial plan.
Right.
So why not have David first step it up a little bit? Just take a little more of the burden upon himself. And gradually you start bringing a little extra funding into that until finally you guys have a set game plan for bringing it down. And the trick to that, set a target date.
Okay.
You know, just don't think that it's going to be one of those nebulous things. Actually sit down, look at the payments, crunch the numbers and say, okay, if we make X amount of payments on a monthly basis, we can be debt-free, at least in terms of this loan, by this date. You set the target date, you come up with a plan, and a plan is always the best way to approach these big ticket expenses. And tell me a little bit about the $36,000 debt. What's the interest rate on that?
Okay, so his student loans they're at different rates, and there's 36,000 of that is at a 6.8% interest rate, which is the highest on all of the loans.
Although it could be a lot worse.
Yes, it could.
Yeah, I've heard about a lot of debts. I mean, for instance, credit card debt, which can be easily topping 30% sometimes. So I think that's the one, if you can break them out, can you go for one specific loan first and then hit the others?
We can. I mean, I think what we can do is, you know, each of the loans needs a minimum payment every month, but we could definitely target one with a higher payment.
That's the smart idea. Go after the one that has the highest interest rate first.
Okay.
Bring that down and then let the other ones fall in line behind it. And that way you're staying ahead of the hangman, you know?
Yes.
Okay. And then going forward, do you guys have a financial plan for, you know, what follows? Will it be a completely pooled incomes, or are you going to keep separate accounts? Do you have an idea?
I think that we are going to wind up pooling most of our accounts together. We both also work as freelance, so it adds a level of complexity in there. So I think we're planning on joining our finances just so we can kind of keep an eye on everything together.
And I think that's terrific. I mean, like I say, I think that's just a very important part of creating a lasting relationship. But here's the thing, Valerie. Make sure you guys have the conversations. Talk about how much do we want to spend? How much do we want to save? What is our retirement plan?
Right.
How much do we want a vacation? You know, and start looking at those big ticket expenses and get yourself onto the same page so that all of those decisions are joint decisions.
Right.
That's the trick. And once you guys see eye to eye on this sort of thing, then it becomes easier and you can start divvying up the pain in terms of making those financial decisions, the actual day-to-day money management, because you've created an element of financial trust, and that's so important.
Yeah, I totally agree.
All right. So first of all, Valerie, congratulations from all of us. Second
Thank
of
you.
All, let us know after the wedding in September what you do. Send us an email and just kind of keep us up to speed on how things are going, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Take care now.
Thank you.
All right. Let's look around. I got an email here, and this one caught my eye because it's a little bit unusual. It's from Lucy in Chicago. And what made it intriguing to me is she attended 2 years of medical school and then said, you know what? this doctor thing, not for me. Walks away from med school, but she's got about $115,000 in student loans hanging over her head with, like the last caller, a 6.8% interest rate. Lucy says she's working, making about $30,000 a year before taxes, living expenses not very high, keeping her credit cards in control. So she says she's got about $1,000, $1,500 each month to do something with. And her question, like a lot of people, do I pay down that debt or do I think about saving? And I think this is probably one of those universal questions that a lot of people have when they've got a little bit of extra liquid cash and they're trying to figure out what's the smart play for the money. The smart play is yes and yes. And by that I mean, don't put it into an either-or situation, pay down the debt or save. You got to be doing both at all times. And saving for retirement, I just can't emphasize this enough. It's crucial. And Americans, for some reason, seem to think, you know what, I can just put that off and put that off, and somehow the retirement fairy will come along and sprinkle pixie dust over me and bail me out. And it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Moreover, if you're relying on Social Security, well, it'll be there, but it's not exactly going to be there perhaps in the form that it is right now. By that, I mean costs will be higher, benefits might be reduced. Therefore, you need to keep your eye on all of your costs and make sure you're managing all your money simultaneously. So, Lucy, in answer to the question, let's say you've got about $1,000 to play with. Well, you could go $500 here, $500 there if you want. That's a nice even breakdown. If you want to be more aggressive with the loan, okay, not a bad idea, as long as you're not overlooking your retirement planning, which is crucial. And also remember this, you and everyone else who has any form of student debt, if you run into trouble, if you have to declare bankruptcy, student debt doesn't go away. So it's a thing, and you don't want to kind of leave it there and just kind of think that things will work themselves out, because they won't. It'll stay there. So, in answer, do it all. Throw that money at various places at a pace you're comfortable with. And as you're seeing the student debt coming down, maybe you want to shift a little bit more money into your retirement savings. Keep your eye on all balls simultaneously, and you are a financial winner. And Lucy, send me another email. Let me know what you decide to do, okay? All right, we're going to take a quick break here. Stick around, because I'm going to take another call in just a moment. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus, and I'm back with Alana calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Alana.
Hello.
All right, let's do the Chamber of Commerce a favor. Give me two reasons why I want to spend my next vacation in Minneapolis.
There is a lot of things to see and do here. There's a ton of theater and art pieces and dance and museums, and it's really great, especially in the summer.
And that's one. Okay, what's another?
And the other thing, of course, is the Mall of America that everyone wants to see because it's gigantic.
You know, that wasn't really high on my bucket list, I have to say.
All right, good.
But I'm looking
not
forward
high on
to
mine
it.
Either.
Yeah, nevertheless, I'm looking forward to it now. So tell me, Alana, what's going on in your life money-wise?
So I recently got a settlement check. I got injured at work. And I got a large check, which is supposed to cover my medical bills and the future surgery I will eventually have.
Okay, time out. Can I ask about the injury?
Sure.
Well?
I was working. I am a freelancer who works in theater, or I was at the time. And I got injured tearing stuff down. And I shattered my heel.
Ew.
Yeah, it was really bad.
All right, so tell me about that financial settlement.
So, you know, 2 years later and a bunch of lawyers and hassles and stuff, I got a settlement for $32,000.
So you mentioned that you're looking at surgery again down the road. That I assume that's for the foot.
Yep, that's for the foot. Eventually, I'll be in enough pain that just fusing the joint will be the best thing for me.
Are you in pain now?
Not usually. If I'm on my feet a whole bunch, or if I do things that kind of, like if I'm on ladders or something that asks a little bit more of my foot, then it hurts quite a bit.
All right. So you're looking at dealing with that down the road. Do you have health insurance?
I do have health insurance.
Is it true?
Just recently got a new employer, so I'm no longer freelancing, and they have a nice health insurance plan.
Okay, so you got a group plan, and even if you didn't, thank you very much, Obamacare, you wouldn't be turned away, even with that big old pre-existing condition you're now carrying around.
True.
So, what's to worry about?
Well, I want to know what to do with this giant chunk of money that I don't need now, but in theory, I should need in 15 years to pay for these medical bills that I'll have. Like, even with insurance, there's going to be deductibles and there's going to be long-term care and things that won't be covered.
I hear you. Now, first of all, things like physical therapy, for example, should be covered on most plans. And one of the things about the Affordable Care Act is it makes all plans more comprehensive so that now an insurer just can't turn you away and say, we're not going to do any physical therapy for you. Good luck. It's not the case anymore. So I think
True.
Going forward, you can expect your coverage, whether it's through a group employer plan or an individual policy, to have a lot more leeway in terms of dealing with these medical issues. Is it important for you to kind of segregate that money and know that it's there just in case?
Sort of. I mean, the other thing is eventually I'll not be able to do my job because I need my foot to work. So there's a little bit about that that I think is also part of the medical thing. And I just kind of like the theory of keeping this check as a unit to not separate it out and distribute it into different things. I kind of want to put it somewhere so that it can be much bigger, or it can make a big impact later and be like, look, I saved all of this money and now it's twice as big or whatever.
Tell me about your other savings. What other things do you have?
I have a good savings. I have probably 30,000 maybe saved. I have like 19 in retirement things, Roth IRA and things, and I have 20 or 30,000 in just liquid money.
Okay. My advice in a situation like this is, since it's important to you to keep that money in a little extra special place, just for peace of mind, if nothing else, you don't want to put it necessarily into your retirement fund. So let's not put it in with the Roth, but let's keep a couple of things in mind. If you put that money in a separate spot and not pool it with your other liquid funds, you're going to be denying yourself potentially higher returns through the miracle of compounding, which means you got more money being saved, it's earning more interest, it's rolling over, and it will start saving more money and working harder for you over the long haul.
Sure.
So that's the reason you want to pool your funds. And I wouldn't dismiss that out of hand. Here's the thing, though. The amount of risk you're prepared to take on for these savings is a factor, because you're anticipating healthcare costs down the road. You're anticipating therapy. You're anticipating life changes that may or may not be covered by insurance. And that's a reason to protect yourself from any of the uncertainties that might be coming down the road, which means you want to temper the amount of risk that you take on. And what does that mean? Probably less exposure to stocks, more exposure to things like bonds, the money market, relatively lower risk investments that will still bring in more money than just putting it in the bank and getting a 0.0001% savings rate.
Mm-hmm.
How's that sound?
Sure.
Well, you don't sound very enthusiastic about that.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, it seems good.
Well, it seems good because it is good, but that doesn't mean that it's one size fits all. And that's why I really want to stress to you, Alana, that these decisions, as everybody else's financial decisions, are their own and they have repercussions. So you want to not go into this willy-nilly. But just having talked to you and having, you know, appreciated the fact that you're a robust supporter of the Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce, I would say you don't want a lot of risk. And I would say that when you talk to a financial advisor, when you talk to a broker, when you talk to somebody who's dealing in financial products, that's the thing you want to emphasize. Keep the risk down. Tell me how I can maximize my returns over time and help me make sure that this money is going to be there for me, not 5 years from now, but maybe 10 years from now, 15 years from now. Always keep your eye on the time horizon.
Okay, got it.
Okay, a little more enthusiasm.
Yay!
All right, that's what I'm talking about. And as you go forward, Alana, keep us posted. Send me an email. Let me know what your decisions are, because it's always interesting to hear where people go, not just with the advice, but the decisions that they make on their own, because I can tell you only so much, and then it's balls in your court, and I want to hear what you do, okay?
Cool. Great.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Yep. Thank you.
Coming up, looking for a way to cover healthcare costs, save a little money, all without paying federal income taxes? Time to learn about health savings accounts.
One of the biggest mistakes that people make with HSAs is they think they need to use it like a flexible spending account. They get that debit card from the bank, and then they use it for their medical expenses every year. But if you can afford to use other cash to pay for those medical expenses and keep the HSA money in there growing for the future, this is a great source of tax-free money for the future.
That's up next on Marketplace Money from APM. Deductibles, rising premiums, we're getting hammered by the high cost of health care. In fact, even employers are feeling the pinch. So a lot of them are encouraging their workers to take a closer look at what's known as health savings accounts, or HSAs. But are these things for everyone? Well, to find out, we turn to Kim Lankford from Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Hiya, Kim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So an HSA, a health savings account, one size fits all?
No, not really. But it is an option for many more people, especially as more employers and individuals buying their own coverage are having to deal with higher health care deductibles. This is one way to stretch your dollars because you get a triple tax break from a health savings account.
All right. But explain, this isn't insurance per se. It's a financial vehicle that is coupled with insurance.
That's correct. So as long as you have a deductible for an individual policy of at least $1,250 or $2,500 for family coverage, then you are likely to be able to qualify for a health savings account. There's a few other nuances, such as whether everything else is covered or not. So you need to ask your health insurer whether it qualifies. But in that case, then you can open up a health savings account. And you can open this up with a bank, with a brokerage firm. If you have an employer policy, a lot of them couple those with HSA as it is. And sometimes employers even contribute some money themselves. The key thing is that you will get a tax break up front. It'll either be pre-tax if through your employer or tax deductible if you're doing it on your own. The money grows tax deferred, and then you can use it tax-free in any year for medical expenses. And this is a key distinction from flexible spending accounts where you have to use the money or lose it by the end of the year or can only carry over $500. This you can keep forever. You can keep it until retirement and use that money for your Medicare expenses, which is a great way to build a tax-free stash of money for future healthcare costs.
So let's underline that point. An HSA is, in effect, a tax shelter for medical purposes, and all the money you put into it carries over from year to year. So once you put it in, it's still yours.
That is correct. And one of the biggest mistakes that people make with HSAs is they think they need to use it like a flexible spending account. They get that debit card from the bank, and then they use it for their medical expenses every year. And for many people, they may need to do this. They may not be able to afford to use other money for those costs, especially as they're dealing with higher deductibles. But if you can afford to use other cash to pay for those medical expenses and keep the HSA money in there growing for the future, this is a great source of tax-free free money for the future, which is a great complement to maybe your 401ks and your IRAs, where you may have to pay taxes when you withdraw the money. This is money that will be tax-free as long as it's used for medical expenses. You can use it for your deductibles, your co-payments. And then once you're Medicare age, you can't contribute to the HSA after you sign up for Medicare, but you can still use the money tax-free. You can use it for your Medicare Part B and Part D premiums. You can use it for Medicare Advantage premiums, even for part of long-term care insurance costs. So there's a lot of things you can use the money for, so you won't ever have to pay taxes on it.
Let's zero in on the insurance that accompanies the HSA typically. The rates, the premiums, are going to be relatively low because the deductible is going to be fairly high, and that means more upfront out-of-pocket expenses.
That is correct. And you're right. A lot of these policies, these are the higher deductible policies that many employers are gradually shifting to, that many of the exchanges had for bronze and silver especially. And as more people are having to pay higher premiums, a lot of them are choosing to have higher deductible options. But they realize that they've got to be able to come up with that money to pay those costs out of their pocket before the insurance kicks in. So that's the key thing. You need to be very, very aware of how those policies work.
So who is this the best deal for, a young invincible or somebody older who actually has some medical conditions?
Well, you know, it's really great for people who don't have many medical expenses, because then you're really not having to pay up towards that deductible anyway. And if you have a policy through your employer, that's an especially good time to do that math, because some employers are really trying to motivate people to go towards the high deductible policies. And their Fidelity says that it's not unusual for them to contribute about $500 into the HSA for individual accounts and about $1,000 for the year for family accounts, just to kind of nudge you in that direction. So especially if you have an employer offering it, see if there's some extra breaks just for signing up, or even some additional breaks for signing up for wellness benefits.
But it's clearly not for everyone. For example, when my employer offered the choice of an HSA or a traditional insurance plan, well, I've got type 1 diabetes, which means I've got a lot of fixed medical costs, insulin, test strips, the whole gamut. It didn't look like a good deal for me.
Well, and that's the key thing, is don't just look at premiums. And anyone who has regular medical expenses can do this calculation when they're given their choices at open enrollment. You need to just not just look at those premiums, but look at what are your regular expenses for medicines, what are your regular expenses for doctors. And if you do have, you know, a medical condition where you have similar expenses every year, do that math and add it up. Some cases you may come out ahead with the lower premiums. Some cases the higher premiums may actually leave you with lower out-of-pocket expenses by the end of the year.
So as we said, more and more employers are encouraging their workers to look at this. What's in it for the business?
Well, the employers save money. I mean, they are looking for any way that they can help lower their healthcare costs, because they've been stretched so much. They always provide a large percentage of the premiums. Generally, employers pay about 75% or so of employees' premiums. And they also realize that if you have a high deductible policy, it's also in your best interest to shop around and look for some of the less expensive healthcare, which then can help the employers save some money, because they're being stretched so hard themselves.
And we're all about saving our employers some money. Kim Langford writes for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Marketplace Money from APM. It's mid-May, and that means we are smack in the middle of cap and gown season. Most of us will be bestowing some kind of gift on the newly minted grad in our lives. In my case, my son's not quite there yet, but my nephew is on track to graduate soon. All right, so what is the best way to acknowledge all their hard work while squeezing in a little financial lesson at the same time? For that answer, we turn to personal finance columnist Liz Weston. Hiya, Liz.
Hi, David.
Let's say that I'm not going to go out and get my nephew a brand new Mercedes or BMW, but I still want to say, good job, dude. Way to go. What's the best way to express that financially?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different gifts that you can buy a graduate, but honestly, nothing beats cash. I am not a big fan of cash in other situations as gifts. I don't think gift cards are really great gifts. But when it comes to graduates, we have a generation here that's, you know, more indebted than any before, probably has student loans, probably has credit card debt. And really, probably the best thing you can do for them is a nice fat check.
And also, this generation, one hopes, is going to get out on their own and not come back to live with you. Thus, this also helps provide a little, you know, a little juice there as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people sort of expect now that they're going to come home for a while to get their, you know, feet under them before they launch out. And perhaps having a little bit of cash put aside might accelerate the day that they actually launch.
I saw Pew Research had a report out just the other day saying that more than a third of millennials will be coming home to live with their folks, which places a financial strain, well, not just on them, but on their folks as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and look down the road, I think we'll see a lot of those parents moving back in with their kids because they haven't saved enough for retirement.
I'm just curious then, if cash is king with grads, how much?
You know, that's a really good question, and it varies so much by family. I mean, you have family where it's common to give hundreds of dollars, you know, even to more distant relations or friends. And you have other families where 25 bucks is considered pretty good. So this is one of those things that I really can't give you guide rails on. This is something you have to kind of feel out for yourself. I would say be as generous as you can because, again, you're helping a young person get started.
Let's say, and this isn't the truth, but let's say I was concerned that my nephew would blow this money on things that, well, would not be as prudent as they might otherwise be. What are other ways to package this acknowledgement of their achievement?
I had an aunt who bought two of her children one of my books and included that. Don't do that. I mean, it's an etiquette thing. You do not want to beat your children over the head with personal finance books. I know some people love that, but, you know, I really do think that when it's a gift, it's a gift. You're letting it go.
But can I make an investment on their behalf, for example?
You know, that's really, it's a great idea. It's just such a hassle because you have to set up a brokerage account. You have to know their social security number. This is something a parent might do for a child, you know, to get them started. What you might do is give some uncle advice and tell them, hey, as soon as you can, set up that Roth IRA. That is the best thing since sliced bread. So that's more, I think, along the lines of something you might want to do than actually purchase shares or a mutual fund or something like that. Because as I said, there's levels of hassle there that most families won't want to go through.
What if I wanted to step up and say, I know you've got some debt now. I want to help pay that down.
That would be awesome. I mean, a direct check from you to the credit card company, that's the way to find out. You know, you're making sure at that point that the money's going to its best possible use, which is getting rid of toxic debt. So if the grad is up for that and up for, you know, being willing to give you his account number and tell you where the debt is, you know, like Citibank or Bank of America or whatever, that's a very nice gesture.
We talk a lot on this program about the importance of planning for retirement. A new college grad obviously is still in that invincible phase where he or she just can't even see the finish line. Is it at all helpful or maybe even pushy to say, you know what, I want to give you something to acknowledge this, and I want to also do something to steer you down the road, and thus you start putting something together for retirement purposes?
Yeah, I really would love to hear more people talking about that to new grads because what they hear is, debt is bad, pay off your student loans as soon as possible. And what you see is a bunch of kids doing that and passing up all these wonderful opportunities to save for retirement. You know, they're missing out on the Roth. They're missing out on the company match with their 401k. You can't get back those opportunities. You can't get back an opportunity to fund a Roth. You can't get back a tax break that you would have gotten for the money that you put into a 401k or the match. And that money, now that they're in their 20s, has so much longer to grow. I mean, if you start in your 30s and you put $1,000 in a Roth, you'll have $10,000 by the time you get to retirement age. That's not shabby. If you start in your 20s, you'll have twice as much. So that $1,000 will grow to $20,000. That's just the power of compounding and getting that early start. So if we did have everybody say, hey, you know, I know that you really want to pay down this debt. You should do that over time. But the most important thing is get started saving for retirement. Start from your first job. Never stop. Keep going. And if they don't happen to have a 401k, you know, an IRA is fine. But really, I'm a big fan of getting those Roths started. If you get $10,000 for graduation, take half of it and put it into a Roth. You will be happy later.
What would be your advice to a new grad who says to you, thank you so much for this, and there's all these hot tech stocks out there, Alibaba's going public, I'm going to invest?
Maybe we let them make a few mistakes early on that they learned from. I would again emphasize, hey, look, this Roth thing, it's going to be tax-free in retirement. I know that seems like a long way off. At least put it in your Roth before you buy the Alibaba stock.
Financial columnist Liz Weston, thank you as always for your great advice.
It's my pleasure.
Our upbringings shape who we are in every way, and that includes how we think about money. Today, an author and humorist in North Carolina talks about her parents.
My name is Celia Rivenbark, and I am a syndicated humor columnist. I am an author. I am a mommy. And I'm a Southerner. I grew up in a very tiny house with a great big garden out back. And the garden figured heavily in how well we were going to eat for the rest of the year, the summer and the rest of the year. Because my dad would grow everything we ate, and then my mom would freeze and can everything. And that was the beauty of growing up in the country. Everybody knew how to can and freeze. This was, you know, I mean, this was very common growing up. This is the way, it was kind of a great economy that we had going there. My mom would have, she was a pioneer of yard sales. She would just drag all our crap out of the house and put it on the front yard. And ever who came by, she would say, here, this is for sale. And I can remember coming by, and she did it like every Saturday for years. And I can remember coming home and said, why are my dresses all on the front yard? And she said, well, my inventory was running low. My dad was a teacher at this point, but I can remember how he wore dentures. And he could afford to get new dentures, but he liked the challenge of gluing the old ones back together every time they broke. So he would brew up this ghastly epoxy thing, and then he would patch the dentures together, and they'd last another year. And when you see something like that, you really understand how we really can waste money sometimes. I'll tell you a funny thing about my dad, and this is the oddest. It's odd, but it's funny. He died 6 years ago, and he died in a nursing home after only 4 weeks. It was very sudden, just went on the decline. And the day before he died, the administrator came into his room and said, can we talk? And I thought he was asleep, and she thought he was asleep. And she explained how he had been paid, his room had been paid 400%, but as of one more day, we would have to start kicking in. And he died that night. And there is not one doubt in my mind. I could just picture him saying, oh, no, 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 this money is for my family. And that's just the way he was. And I've got the humor column, and I've written 7 books in 13 years, and I do a fair amount of public speaking. I sometimes think how unfair it is that my daddy taught special ed for 25 years and never made what I make just writing fart jokes for a living. He had a noble career, me not so much, but he would have loved the money.
Celia Rivenbark is a columnist and the author of Rude Bitches Make Me Tired, Slightly Profane and Entirely Logical Answers to Modern Etiquette Dilemmas. It's her 7th book. Send us your own lessons in family finance. Tweet us at LiveMoney or record your story at MarketplaceMoney.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Lizzie O'Leary is off pounding nails and sawing wood to put together our new show, Marketplace Weekend. Barbara Vogue will be in the big chair next week. Marketplace Money is produced by Candice Manriquez and Caitlin Finaro, with help from Lindsay Foster Thomas. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. The theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Remember to always check with your financial professional before making any big money decisions. I'm David Lazarus. Until next time, I'll see you in the business section.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.